Welcome back to Label, the stories, rumors, and legends of Tooth & Nail Records. I'm your host, Matt Carter, and today we're going to take an adventure with Jimmy Ryan. Jimmy's the original lead singer of Haste the Day, and he's in a rare category in which his band was a breakout band in the pinnacle of the Tooth & Nail Solid State Golden Age, but Jimmy was not a Tooth & Nail kid. The rest of his band certainly were. They were youth group kids from a nice Indianapolis suburb when they joined forces with Jimmy, who was also considerably older than them, and for better or worse, became the tour dad. And even though Jimmy didn't grow up a Tooth & Nail kid, he was a perfect fit to continue the long tradition of solid state bands who would bring intensity to the mission of mosh and ministry. So I think you will enjoy this episode. It gives a really great look into the personality. And this conversation gives a great look into the character and person of Jimmy Ryan. I think you'll really enjoy it. If you haven't yet checked it out, please check out Labeled Deep Dives. That's a series we're doing right now on the making of Under Oath's new record, Voyeurist, where we go deeply into their process and the production and their relationships and how those things all fit together to create things at the level that they're able to do. So that's going really, really well. Had a great conversation with Spencer and Aaron that is coming out or is out now. So check that out. Just look for Labeled Deep Dives in your podcast app or go to the Labeled Universe YouTube channel where there's video of everything there too. So check that out. And here's Jimmy and me. Well, let's spend some time just trying to do, you know, it's definitely a lot of reflection kind of involved to go back, because a lot of the stuff that I want to talk about is way, way, way in your past, you know, from, I want to start maybe even in your childhood and stuff. I think what's really fascinating is that the time that you come into Solid State and Tooth & Nail in the scene's history with when Haste the Day's first record comes out is right at this real heyday of the height of everything. And it took a while until that infrastructure and everything was there for bands like yours to be able to break out, especially coming from, you know, different places. There's been all these regions like Southern California or Seattle, and Florida had a lot going, but eventually there's just incredible talent consolidating in places like Carmel, Indiana. You know sure. what I mean? So yeah. I just want to get like, this is a cool ability for us to like take a tour into growing up Midwest, you and your friends and the people around that. I'm really curious what your early musical experiences were and how you got to experiencing, you know, something that you would have called a scene.
Sure. So Matt, when I was in grade school, I don't know if it was the way that my mom dressed me or what, but I was just such a dork. And I was kind of, the best way to describe it is I remember sitting in class in like fourth or fifth grade and Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th were like huge. It was a big deal if like you got to watch those shows. And I wasn't allowed, but the kids would, the boys would get behind me on purpose in class and start talking about Nightmare on Elm Street or like a horror movie and be like, hey, do you remember when Jason did this in the movie or when Freddy did this in the movie? And they would be making things up and I'd turn around and be like, yeah, I remember that too. And they're like, that didn't happen. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like they just set me up for failure and I got picked on a lot. And that kind of carried over into high school. But in eighth grade, there was a Knights of Columbus club down the street from where I went to school. And they started having hardcore shows on Friday nights. And that was my first job. I was bussing tables at the Knights of Columbus. So I started going to all these hardcore shows. And
you were how old?
I was probably 13-ish. And started going to all these hardcore shows and there were all these people there that like were different and like stood for something. And I was just like, what is this? I want it, you know? So when I was 13, I started going to shows and I got real involved with like, in the Midwest, there was a huge like vegan straight edge hardcore scene. And I got super involved with that. And it was something that I felt a part of, accepted, and something that I could grow with. We had a collective venue called the Sitcom Collective, where bands like Green Day, the Ataris, like these bigger bands came to play. It was in a basement of a furniture store, and we just ran it as kids. And it was just something that I became part of. And I was in
bands. You were doing playing music at that point too?
I just started playing music. I was in a band called Upheaval. It was this vegan straight edge death metal band. We were on, this is terrible, Eulogy Records out of Florida. And you know, at that point in time, I was against anything that was the man. And tied into that was Jesus. And, you know, I hated the idea of Christianity or structured religion.
It wasn't in your upbringing? Your family wasn't Christian?
I was raised Catholic, but it was just kind of, you know, whatever. You know, so we had these pretty brutal lyrics and whatever. Well, there was this girl that started coming to our shows that like was very attractive. And I was like, man, I need to talk to her. So we started talking and I found out she was a Christian. And I was like, oh my gosh, dude, how's this going to work? So I remember telling my friends, I was like, I bet you I could hook up with her if I went to church with her. So I went, and through a long series of events that I won't get into, I met Jesus over the next year. And I kind of stepped out of that scene for a while. When I met the Lord, like 3 weeks later, I went to Bible college and I kind of disappeared. I kind of disappeared from the scene.
Were you still with that girl, or that it was unrelated to that? That was just how you got going on the path.
That's how I got along the path. And, I mean, God used it big time. It's funny what he knows we need, but, you know, I went to Bible college. I went to Mexico like 6 times. I studied in Israel for a few weeks. I spent a lot of time in Ukraine and Nicaragua working in orphanages. And, I started teaching Bible studies. Like there was a huge shift in who I was. And I lost touch with a lot of those people that I had grown up with, but I still had that like kind of punk rock attitude against the man or whatever it was, you know? And,
that's pretty extreme life change. Like the, you know, the people that have the ability to shift their social fabric in order to meet goals. I mean, that's most people don't have that flexibility of personality, you know, or something.
So it's interesting that part of my personality, because I don't know if you know this, but I've been in recovery for 6 years. I really struggled with alcohol big time, and I've been sober for 6 years this past January. And that part of my personality can be the best or worst part of me, because I am 100% in what I'm doing. And I was 100% into being vegan straight edge. And I went 100% into following the Lord. Thankfully, that part of me never went away. Like I still love Jesus with all my heart. But if that part of my personality is channeled in a good way, like I'm going to be the best husband, I'm going to be the best father that I can be, I'm going to go to work and pay taxes and love people well, then man, I can be unstoppable. But if that's shifted the wrong way, I'm going to be the best cigarette smoker, the best drinker, you know what I mean? Like it shifts. So yeah, that's always been in me. And I think it can be a real big positive or a negative depending on which direction I'm going.
Is that an obsessive quality? A drive? Like how do you describe the feeling that makes you do that?
That's a really interesting question.
What does it feel like when you're pursuing a new
goal? There is a drive. that's there. I've struggled with depression my whole life. I've been on antidepressants since I was 14 years old. And I think that drive that you're asking me about, that drive more than an obsession is a way of like having to live, like having to fight against certain things in my mind. So I have to pursue something else, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's kind of strange.
No, I'm sure it's a lot of people have different versions or of that. I think it's not a, I think that probably resonates with a lot of people in different ways. Sure. You know, a lot of people that achieve things are, you know, they get that's, I think that's common, that something like that, even though it's pretty hard to describe and everybody's very, very unique, but it certainly makes sense with addiction and achievement, or even just deep focus on things. Sometimes go, a lot of people who have substance problems are also capable of pretty deep focus, I think.
Sure.
Or things like that, you know. Yeah. That's fascinating. So that spiritual path then links back to music after you've done some of these Bible International. Are you evangelized? Is it evangelist in nature when you're doing on that part?
When I was overseas, is that what you're asking
about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was more just coming alongside organizations that were already doing things. Like in Nicaragua, there was a ex-Navy SEAL that was pastoring a church that was we were essentially helping him. There were boys being taken advantage of sexually by gang members on the street. We were trying to like get them out of that. It was a lot. It was heavy. Through like sleeping on dirt floors and literally hearing like gunshots and whatever, like it made living in a van super easy afterwards. Mm-hmm. But the way that came back around to Haste the Day was, Haste the Day's guitar player, Jason Barnes, was coming to a Bible study that I was going to, here in Indianapolis. And he's like, "Hey, would you come like sing for my band?" And I was like, "Well, what is this?" He's like, "Well, I know you used to sing for bands. I was like, "Yeah, I'll come check it out." And I was on the whole band thing. I was on a totally different like trajectory of my life. Like bands, music was not even a thing anymore. And, but I was like, "This will be fun. I'll try it." And, I went to a practice this one snowy night in Carmel, met the guys, and, screamed for the first time in like 10 years.
And wow.
We all just kind of, those guys were all raised Christians. They were all youth group kids. Mm-hmm. They loved Zayo, and they were like, "Oh my gosh, you sound like Zayo." And it just kind of connected. So that's how that kind of started. And then,
you had already experienced a lot more of life than they had then at that point. I didn't know this, but that kind of colors the way I look at the whole thing, because they were youth group kids that hadn't left their suburb in Carmel or seen or done. Not to mention that previously you'd already been a lead singer in a signed band that had developed, you know.
Yeah. So they were, I'm 8 years older than all of them except for one. So, I mean, they were just turning 18. Like everybody lived with mom and dad. They were just getting out of high school. It was a really unique situation. Mm-hmm. Which we can get into this later, but that kind of leads to why I left.
Yeah, we'll get there. Yeah. Let's just go through this whole path. This is great.
But
I'm learning as I go. I didn't know.
Yeah, I really felt like an older brother and a dad the whole time that I was in that band. And I may not have been the best older brother or dad, but I kind of took on that role, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Oh. That's what it felt like immediately. Just that was the natural fit there.
Yeah.
That speaks to a little bit of your charisma and stage presence, I think, is that like there's a swagger to it that comes on top of that style of music with breakdowns. And I just remember before you even had a record out, when we ran into you and saw you and encountered you, it was just like your stage presence and all that was just like already there. So that probably has a little bit to do with the experience and life experience too. And then being in a more of a kid's realm.
Sure. Yeah. I agree with that.
So how long from when you did that practice until I met you and you were signed or had did that first record, that all happened relatively quick?
Yeah, we, let me see. Two of the guys were in college, Moody Bible College in Chicago. And I was working at a church in Indianapolis, and a couple of other guys were going to IUPUI, and we were playing regional shows like Chicago, Dayton. That's one thing that's great about the Midwest is there's so many cities around that you can travel to and play in different states. And we decided to try a tour out to see if this is something that we could really do. So we had a manager named Mark Lefay. Great man.
I got it written down. I want to spend time just on that person and himself. Yeah. Mark Lefay is a great character in the scene.
Special man. Yeah. He helped us book like an 8-day tour. We played with Under Oath, which was crazy. I think we played with Norma Jean. It was basically just from Indy, Memphis, a couple cities down to Florida and back.
Mark Lefay found you, if you just want to do that part. How did you get with Mark Lefay?
Mark was managing bands and putting on shows, and he took interest in us, and we took it as a huge compliment, you know. We're like, oh my gosh, this guy wants to manage us. We didn't even really know what that meant at the time, but we knew that he wanted to take care of us and we trusted him. So he started pouring a lot of time into us. And I will tell you this, there is no way that Haste the Day would have been signed without Mark Lefay. The guy that signed us at Tooth and Nail's name was Roy Culver. I don't know if you never met Roy.
Oh yeah, we know Roy good. He already said in the Facebook, said, what's up to you already? I got some Facebook fan questions and Roy said, what's up? We know Roy.
I love Roy. He's a good man too, but Mark and Roy had a really great relationship and Mark really pushed for us. You know, we started touring a lot. Everybody decided to drop out of college because Mark was like, if you guys are going to do this, you're going to have to prove that you're going to do this. And we all took that very seriously. I called off an engagement. I broke up with another girl. Like, these guys left college and we were like, all right, let's do this. Let's see if this will work. And that took a lot of trust between each other and a lot of faith to be able to do that. And we did it. We bought a van. We started touring and, it was a really, I remember this kid coming up to me early in our career at a show and saying, what is it like now that you made it? And I was like, man, if making it is sleeping in a van and never seeing your family and making ramen noodles out of coffee makers in hotel rooms, then it's awesome, I guess. Like, you know, it was really hard at first, but it was a really special time.
What was it that you were after? If you had to describe it, was it just heavy music, a style of music, or the evangelistic, the Christian part of that? What was the real shared motivation? Did you have one at the time, or is that just happened to be all the stuff that you were just into and got together?
Yeah, I think that when we first started, and I shouldn't say it like that. It's not like this vision ever faded. It's just when we first set out to do the band, we really had a heart to share Jesus with people that were hurting and lost. And like I told you before, as a kid, like I kind of felt picked on and misfits were always, have always been and will always be my people. And I say misfits, but you understand.
No, I know exactly what you mean.
So we really just wanted to share Jesus with people. And that was an avenue that was pretty unique. And we felt like we could step into. Of course, we loved playing music and all that went along with that. But, you know, when I was in the band, we had some pretty strict rules. Nobody drank. Nobody was ever like making out with girls or whatever. Like it was a really, really strict kind of boat that we were in. I think when I left, some of that changed, but it probably needed to. Not that they were doing anything bad, because they weren't. That's not at all what I mean. It got a little bit more relaxed when Dad left.
Well, I remember that. And first of all, it was really common, but you guys were a real example of that, the band that had tour rules. I mean, there's a code to that in Christian bands, and it's like every band negotiated it different ways, but you would call it accountability or whatever. Cause the idea is like, you got these young kids and you're going out into the world and you got to be careful and you got to stick together and you got to hold each other accountable. You got to be buddies to each other in that way, especially when you feel like you have this mission itself or your witness to protect, like all that stuff is, I'm not saying it's not immature, because ultimately it kind of is, but that's the stage that you're at when those are your goals and your objectives. But I remember you guys having a particularly, more strict as far as the tour code and the rules and what was allowed, but it was pretty explicit for you guys.
Yeah, it was. We kind of held ourselves to a pretty high standard. And I think that at that point in our lives and at the age that all of us were, it was very important. I mean, some could call it legalism or whatever, but at that point in our lives, I think it was important, because there was one time we were in some city and the guys left the van door open and nothing happened. But I remember like screaming at them, like, "You guys were not in Carmel, Indiana anymore." And that became like a saying. Like they will say that to my face this day, like, "We're not in Carmel anymore." Like, but you know, Carmel's this like rich city with these like super nice homes and you can leave your doors unlocked and whatever. And I was like trying to help these guys see, like, we're in the real world. You've never experienced this before. So again, I think at that point in our career and in our lives, I feel like those rules were really important for us. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it completely makes sense. And it probably was necessary to some degree. That stuff's necessary if it's to keep yourself focused on what you want from each other. Then that's just agreements that you make with one another versus legalism. Or, you know, the one that people look worse at, or I look worse at, is the one where it's an image to maintain because you're a Christian artist. So you can't be seen doing X, Y. Like that one, I don't like. But
I agree.
Young men or young people trying to band together to figure out conduct to improve themselves and stay focused on what they are. I mean, whatever they happen to be, it just goes along with your objectives, you know? So it's part of that independent unit, little battalion out there in the wild, like going over here and going over there. Like, how are you going to self-organize? That's the story of a lot of these bands, is what was your method for self-organization and governance? I mean, it's these micro cultures, they all do it a different way.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So how did you get to, so Mark LaFay championed you directly to Tooth and Nail Solid State? Was the link? Because he was doing managing other bands. Had he had other bands get signed at that time?
No, we were his first. He did have a few during and after us, but you know, Mark, he got us in to record with Barry Pointer in Arkansas, who's a kind of a legend. We started recording and we weren't signed yet. We were like in negotiations, almost signed, and we went ahead and went with it, just hoping that Brandon Ebel was going to like pay for our recording.
How did you fund it to Barry?
We were just at one point during the recording, I'm pretty sure that we like stopped because we didn't know if we were going to be able to pay him. We ended up signing while we were recording Burning Bridges. Wow. So that was a weird, stressful time.
03 by this point. It's 03.
Yeah. And again, that was all LaFay and Roy Culver. Like without those two, honestly, like there's no way that chapter of my life would have happened. So, yeah.
That's great. And did you enjoy the process and the outcome with Barry?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, to be totally honest with you, like I never listened to Christian music, like heavy music before. Like, I mean, I had played with Zayo when I was in Upheaval, when I was like 18 or 19 years old. And, I knew who they were. And I think there's a story that, we were playing with them at a church in Muncie, Indiana, and I'm pretty sure that some of my friends set their merch on fire because they were a Christian band. But like, but I the only reason I bring that up is because I didn't know who Living Sacrifice was. I didn't know who like Stavesaker or Further Seems Forever or all these bands were. I didn't even know what Tooth and Nail was or if it was a big deal or not.
So you were officially not a Tooth and Nail kid, as is common.
No, I honestly, like the only, what was Ryan Clark's band a long time ago? Not Training for You. Focal Point. I did go into a Christian bookstore one time to buy a Focal Point tape. That's how long ago this was. But no, I was not a Tooth and Nail kid. It wasn't a big deal to me because I didn't know. The other guys in the band were losing their minds when we were at Barry's because of all the history and people that had recorded there before. I mean, I was flattered and honored and it was fun. And I don't want to act like I was too cool for it. I just didn't understand the magnitude of all of it to these guys that they were feeling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because they were Tooth and Nail kids.
Yeah, big time.
Right. And so you make the record with Barry, you get signed, and then we're almost to the point where you and I meet.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that's when we toured and we had the record for a while. We may still of like most shows during a year. Like we were there was one year that we played, I think it was 311 shows. Wow. That was shows, like not just days gone from home. Like it was all the time. That was the only way we were making money. And we got thrown on a Solid State tour. It was Spencer from Under Oath's first tour. Gosh, Beloved was on that. Norma Jean. It was a really...
I still met you before that though, right? That was after your record was out. We met right before our records came out. Do you remember that?
We played a show together in North Carolina.
Yeah, we played in North Carolina and Virginia at Record Store, just these really small.
Yeah.
Did two or three shows right before both of our records came out. And it was Bowels of Judas, Haste the Day.
Yes, you're right. Oh, I'm so sorry. You're totally right. So that time before the record came out was really important for us to like get our name out and prove ourselves. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was a really exciting time. I do remember that. But man, I remember when we met you guys. I do remember that tour, that show in North Carolina that we played with you and the record store, and just being so confused on why you guys were so kind and humble, because I was like, these guys are going to be freaking giant. I remember thinking that, like us talking about it in the van, like, how are we playing with these guys? Like, You guys were insanely talented. It was amazing.
Well, we didn't have the record out yet either, and neither did you, but we were it was the first time we had played real shows that were kind of getting real at all. But we still didn't have a record out, and we were with you and Mark Lefay, went to Waffle House, and Mark Lefay sat us down at Waffle House. He said, how many records do you think you're going to sell? Because he had the weeks in. I guess you guys had the record. That's probably why he thought we were good, because I don't think we're that good live. But he was like, I think you're going to sell 80,000 of this record. And we died laughing. So I was like, you're crazy. Like that was like, you know, not even close to anything on our radar. And we wound up selling probably twice that of that record. But
yeah,
it was just, it was like the farthest thing from our minds that we were going to be.
80,000.
Well, yeah. Anything. Just like, well, you know, the record wasn't even out. We'd never had fans in another place know our music yet. Like we hadn't even experienced almost anything yet. But yeah, we did have that record. So it was a weird time in that way. But I just remember Mark, and I just thought I just still to this day think Mark's one of the coolest people, most interesting people. And he was just such a, I mean, it's just such a hustler and such a he's such a focused person on what he's doing. He was so focused on you, and he knew the whole Tooth and Nails. Like he understood the world and the mechanics of it all in an incredibly deep way, you know.
He did. And man, he fought for us so hard. I mean, literally, I remember one time Mark didn't need to reflect our Christian attitude because he wasn't in the band. And I remember being in Texas, in Dallas, and the promoter not being able to pay us because either we didn't have a guarantee that night or there weren't enough kids or whatever. And I remember Mark going into the promoter's office and telling him, we're going to the bank machine or I'm going to break your fingers. he got our money. So yeah, he hustled hard.
That's awesome. And so that was January. That was January of 2004. And our record came out the following like week or two after that. That was the last shows we played before we had a record out. And then your record came out in March or something like that. Like it was coming out right after that. It was the next two Tooth and Nail releases were basically those two at that year.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And so I remember my story about what happened after that, but what, I mean, right there when your record came out, it like first week did super good. And do you remember how that experience of having your first week and being blasted it to a new level? Because where we both were weeks before our records came out, I mean, it was a pretty night and day difference.
Yeah. The great thing about then, Matt, was like, you know, I'm sure you remember when we were touring back then, we had to look at paper atlases. Because there was no iPhones or anything like that. Like we were navigating with that. So the great thing about that period of time was there was no internet and we couldn't read the bad reviews, you know? So we were just so stoked that the record was out and we heard that it was doing well and we had a great work ethic. Our manager was happy. Like the label seemed happy. It just made us want to work so hard. You know, it was such an exciting time. I still just remember feeling like I was part of this machine that was like moving forward. You know, it was really, really special.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause the label was at its, you know, reaching its stride in this peak kind of time of reach and power and growth.
Yeah.
And then you had a team and then you had a record. You're riding that wave, you know?
Yeah.
And then that rhythm right after that is when you must've got on the Solid State tour and which is just one of the wildest tour lineups possible. I remember we were out during that time and hearing the stories of those, of that tour specifically. That's an insane thing. I don't remember the lineup exactly. I don't want to missay. I think I know who it is, but
yeah,
about that tour.
It was like us, Beloved, Norma Jean, Under Oath, Dead Poetic.
Yeah.
I think that was it. And we opened every night as we should have. I mean, we were the smallest and newest band and, gosh, that tour was just insane. I remember in Houston, there were so many kids outside that couldn't get in that we just decided to do the show twice.
Like I heard that one. I remember
that. We did the show And then we did it again. Like everybody played their set again that night. It was amazing.
Sold out twice or something in the same room. Unplanned. Yeah.
Wild. Like it was just like all those bands. It was so cool because there was no competition on that tour. It wasn't like, oh, well, more people are going to listen to like Dead Poetic than us or what. It was like every band member from every band watching every show, singing along, like hardcore dancing in the crowd. Like it was really, really special. Like everybody was just cheering for one another. And that kind of carried over into what I feel like is like a brotherhood that still exists today for a lot of us, you know. It was a really neat thing.
A lot of tours aren't that way, but a lot, it's like shows and tours are this way. They can be just normal ways, or they can be this really special thing when it just all fits and it all works and it all works as one unit kind of thing.
Yeah.
But when it works like that, it's like this ultimate summer camp, you know, like every relationship is super deep and can never be replaced. And it's in every direction for the whole unit moving across the country together for 40 days or something like that. It's an experience that most tours don't really get that. And especially later as time goes on. But I mean, that's a very rare thing. And it has to do with, as we spoke at the beginning, that shared, like everybody's experience to get to that moment had a lot of parallels and shared meaning and care and layers to it.
You're right. And I don't know that I thought about it like in the moment, but looking back, Matt, you're totally right. Like we all fought for the same thing and we all sacrificed and gave up things to get there. I don't know that any of us were like mature enough to think about that at the time.
but also had the same, like of the same types of musical textures and the same, you know, spiritual faith and the same, you know, preferences for food, probably, you know what I mean? You had so many things in common, you know, that's just so cool.
It was cool, man. What a cool time of life.
And so that was one of your first tours, was some experience like that. And then you got a bunch of opportunities, you know, from there still while, you know, and during your time in Haste Today. So what do you remember as the whirlwind of the next, because what do we have, another year and something left with you in the band?
Well, after that tour, we had another, we recorded another record that I did with them called When Everything Falls, that I believe came out in 2005. And, you know, the process of that, we were up in Vancouver, Canada with Garth Richardson, which was a huge deal because, I mean, he had worked with Rage Against the Machine, you know what I mean? Which Zach from Rage Against the Machine was in a hardcore band called Inside Out that I was like a huge fan of when I was young. And working with Garth was awesome. We were up in Vancouver. We were there for probably, I think, 2 months. And we got to record at a studio that Old Dirty Bastard recorded at, you know, like all these like cool names. And the label got us a condo on Stanley Park, and we were like just having a blast. It was a really cool time. You know, I think some of my favorite tours looking back were with like Azalea Dying. We played with a few times, we did a few tours with Azalea Dying and got pretty close with those guys. Norma Jean and Every Time I Die, you know, there was just some really, really great tours. I loved being on tour. Like the recording process was fun and the rehearsing stuff was fun, but my favorite thing was just being with the people. Like one of the things that I tell people often is, and I think you being a musician can attest to this, like when I was in the band, and I say that because there was a shift when I left in a very good way, and we can talk about that in a few minutes, but when I was in the band, we were young and we were not that great. Like we weren't musically like mature yet. And I remember every night just feeling like the worst band on stage in my head. I never said that to the guys, but just like, why are we headlining? There's these other bands are so much more talented than us. But I think what really helped us grow as a band was that we loved people and we loved people really well. Like, I would sit on the edge of the stage and talk to people, and they would bring their parents in to talk with me. And like, I feel like that was kind of endearing to people. And I feel like that's partly why we succeeded. I'm not saying that has anything to do with me. It was the whole band, the band as a whole. All five of us loved people. We loved the kids that were coming to shows, and we loved their parents. And we were able to like foster these incredible relationships with people, other band members, whatever. Like, but I think that that kind of helped me stay humble. Like, I never felt like, holy crap, I'm amazing. It was just the tour dad that loves people. You know,
tour dad. Okay. I like that. So, does that start to, you know, I don't know, you know, there's anything about the circumstances of you leaving Haste Today. I just don't really even recall. I just remember so profoundly the early times. Well, you know, I think one reason it's really concrete in my memory is because doing those shows with Bowels of Judas is where we met Dave. And then Mark, as soon as our drummer left, like a few months later, Mark LaFaye just called me on the phone and said, you got to get this Bowels of Judas drummer. I was like, oh yeah, he was so good. And they sent him on a plane to come to just do an audition with us. And it was Dave's first time. I mean, he was 19. It was his first time on an airplane. And Mark called and said, this is your guy. This is your guy. This is your guy. This is your guy.
Yeah.
And he was totally right. So that, I just wanted to tag that on about Mark LaFaye. Yeah. But I just don't remember in my career losing track of what happened, you know, with you guys or your whole time leaving the band or when that happened or anything like that. So I'd love to go through, you know, what happened there with you. Is, I don't know if it hinges on you being the tour dad or some of the stuff you've hinted at, but.
So, I would say that like.
Seemed like it was going super well is what I'm saying up to this point.
Yeah, it was. We were nearing this pinnacle of like, It was getting to a point to where it was just amazing. And to be honest with you, I think most people don't know this story. I was engaged to a woman, and you know, like I said, I was 8 years older than everybody. So I was 26, 27 when I left the band. All of my peers outside of music were married, owned homes. Some of them were having kids. And in my mind, I remember thinking one night on stage, I'm a 27-year-old man screaming at 16-year-olds. And then I live in a van with my friends. And I was doing the comparison game of, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. I just remember thinking that. And I was playing the comparison game with a lot of my peers at home and things that my friends were doing. And like I said, I was engaged at the time. The woman that I was getting married to actually tried to talk me out of leaving the band. And I think a lot of people probably blamed my exit on her or that the fact that I was getting married. But it had nothing to do with her. I just really felt like at that point in my life, I needed to step out. Now I will say this, and I've never said this before, maybe to anyone ever. So this is a Jimmy Ryan exclusive right here. I only have one regret in my life, and that is the truth. And the one regret that I have in my life is that I left Haste the Day. It's a big one, and it's a heavy one. I think that it is the best thing that happened for that band. And the reason I say that is I love Steven, the guy that replaced me. I feel like Haste the Day got a million times better when I left. They were able to explore musically in ways that they wouldn't have been able to do had I still been in the band. Steven brought so much talent and in songwriting and the way that he could sing and scream and yell and his personality. So I do feel like it was a really great thing for the band that I left, because they got amazing. And I became this huge fan of Haste the Day when I left, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's why I left. I just felt like it was the responsible thing to do, which looking back, that's my one regret, but I can also see how God used it to shape and mold who I am today. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for saying that. And especially if you hadn't expressed it before, what qualifies a regret as something you might would have done differently or something like that? You mean regret in the emotional sense, like you feel like, what do you mean by regret there? If you don't mind me pressing in further.
No, not at all. I'm thankful that you are. I think I just remember when I quit, I just remember laying on a couch and just weeping, like, did I make the right decision? And that's all I had known for the years before that. And I went from, this was a really good lesson for me. I went from being Jimmy from Haste the Day to just Jimmy. And that was a huge shift for me. I think that a lot of us can find our identity in what we do. Like, I have a friend named Matt, actually, that's a plumber. He's Matt the plumber. That's his identity. I was Jimmy, the band guy from Haste the Day. All of a sudden that had been stripped from me, whether that was my fault or not, it was gone. I fell into this crazy dark depression when I quit, because all that I had was wrapped up in who I was in that band. I have a friend that...
You didn't see that? You didn't know that when you'd quit, that, you know, you didn't anticipate that that would feel that way?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I had a friend that, and he still reminds me to this day that... I don't know. Can you see my hands?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He said, it's like Anchorman. I don't know what to do with my hands. But he said, he always says to me, you need to hold everything in your life like this. Like, God can put things in your hands or take them out. If you hold things like this, it's a lot easier for God to take things out and put things in. You can hold on to things like this, and God can still take him out because he's God, but it's really going to hurt when he does it. And that identity of who I was holding like this. I wasn't holding like this, which is why I just fell so hard when I left. And it was super impulsive. It was a very last minute decision. It was super confusing for everyone, including myself. I was just like, this is what I'm doing.
It sounds like it, like you said, the way you described it, I thought you were going to say, well, this happened. And then you said, I was on stage. I got the feeling like maybe I should do this. And then that was that. And then that's a pretty extreme thing. How was that? So it was totally unexpected for the band. How did they handle it?
They were mad at first, but they were also understanding. When I say mad, rightfully so. I mean, they weren't like not talking to me or whatever. It was just like, I remember this feeling of urgency with the guys, like, okay, he's done. Let's find someone. And they did. And they found the best person for the job. So yeah,
it was pretty quick. So you gave it to them pretty clearly, and there was no question about that they would continue on and that's what you wanted and everything.
Absolutely. I definitely wanted them to. Yeah.
Because there's not a tremendous, I mean, losing a lead frontman vocalist is typically pretty hard. It's been done a few times where it worked out really well. And this is a really good example of that. So that's the really cool thing about Haste the Day. that you've got you and Keach that both really belong in that band. It's not because sometimes you replace somebody, a singer, after the first record, and then it's whatever, like August Burns Red or something. Mm-hmm. You know, you get it, or somewhere early in the band's career, and then the one that really makes it was the second guy. And a lot of times somebody leaves after a couple of records and the band is in decline thereafter. But Haste of Day is one of those ones that had a solid enough routine, enough strong enough momentum that it was possible to do.
Yeah. And I think part of what is really important about that was, you know, again, Mark Lefay stepping up and taking such a strong leadership role in the band and keeping the machine going. And another strong part of that was and is Mike Murphy, the bass player. I just got a message from a band, a rather large band, that asked me if we could play a show with them in December. And I had to run it by Mike, because Mike is the boss. He's the owner of the band. He's the guy. And we're not going to do it for a number of reasons. But like, my point is, there's leaders in the Haste Today organization that did a great job of keeping things going when I left. So,
And Mike winds up being the only original member at some point. But then, but you still do stuff with Haste Today. I mean, I don't even know what all is possible is in the future, and all that. So, and I will circle back to that still. But when you leave the band, what do you do immediately? Like, you go, you get married. What's your, you know, career? How do you, what is the identity piece?
Yeah. So I left, I got married like a few weeks later, and, got a job at Starbucks, and my ex-wife now, but my wife at the time, could tell that I was really off. Like, I was a mess. I didn't know what I was doing with my life. Like, I didn't know anything other than the band at the time. And she's like, I remember her asking me, what is it that you want to do with your life? Like, if you could do anything right now, what would you do? And I said, I think I'd want to work for Tooth and Nail. And she said, I'll support you if that's what you want to do. So
when you go to quit, you didn't have that already in mind, or were trying to do that? Just go home and go to Starbucks. I mean, I thought maybe you would quit because you wanted to do another missionary thing,
no. Like
start a church or something.
But no,
just go to training at Starbucks. And I mean, and
yeah,
you're not a Tooth and Nail kid anyway. Something about that all doesn't make even sense to me.
It was so wild, man. Like, it was just, and the thing is, like, it doesn't make any sense. And I wish that, like, I could make it this story where, like, all those crazy things were happening, but it's not. I just quit and went to Starbucks.
That must have been brutal, like, the first couple shifts, like, hourly, just doing
it. Was
thinking,
so wild, man. It was so wild. Like, I grew to love it, but I wasn't there very long. It was like 8 months or something. And I just hopped on the phone with Chad Johnson and was like, dude, I want to come work for you. And he's like, cool, let me talk to Brandon Ebel. And I remember there being conversations back and forth between Brandon and I always got along real well when I was in the band, like really well. And eventually they're like, I flew out there, I talked to Brandon. He's like, okay, let's see if this will work. So we just packed everything into a U-Haul and moved out to Seattle. And I was Chad Johnson's assistant. That was my job.
Wow.
And I had never sat in front of a computer before in my life.
What year? What do you mean? I mean, no computer experience, huh?
Like, nothing. Like, I remember just sitting there and like him wanting me to send sound scan numbers out and me being like not even knowing what like copy and paste was, like just like because I had never like worked with computers before. It sounds crazy, but like at that time period, like I just didn't know anything. And
is it 07?
Yeah, that sounds about right. 07, 08. Yeah. So I move out there, and I had already known everybody at the label. Some really, really great people there. Amanda McKinnon. I know that's not her last name anymore, but Amanda was there, and Zane Tarpo, and John Fraser, and John Dunn, the Clarks, just Jim Worthen. There's some Lori Gerlach. Like there were just some really, really great people there. And immediately welcomed me in, and it was amazing. So I had this unique perspective when working with bands, because I had been in a band, and it was a shock to me, but there were bands that we were signing and working with that like look up to me because I had been in a band. It's always weird hearing, man, I grew up listening to you. That's always weird. Mm-hmm. But it gave me a lot of favor with people. And I learned quickly that working at a label is so much more than business. It's so relational, and it's so much, it's almost like being a counselor, and it's really sweet. I really enjoyed my time there. I know that there's a lot of people that have a lot of different, things to say about Brandon Ebel. Brandon Ebel is an incredible man, and I'm so thankful for him and the way that he believed in me and how kind he has always been to me. I wish that I could have spent more time with him and learned from him, because he's a brilliant man. But yeah.
Well, why was that time limited? How long were you there? What did you accomplish at your time there? What band, what were the projects you were working on?
Yeah. So, I assisted Chad. So I was doing a lot behind the scenes for Under Oath and Anne Berlin. I also worked some with John Dunn. So there were, both of the bands that they were working with, John Dunn and Norma Jean, you guys, and Chad's bands, Under Oath, Anne Berlin, and a bunch of others. Like I was just doing a lot of behind the scenes things for them. Like you guys probably don't even know, but just like little day-to-day stuff. I learned a lot of responsibility. I learned what it was like to have to get up and go to work. I learned what it was like to report to people and be submissive, and not that Tooth and Nail was this weird like thing that I had to obey people, but it was just, I learned what it was like to live normal life, and it was wonderful. My ex-wife wanted to be back in Indy, and I'm not at all vilifying her. She just wanted to be in Indy and was like, I'm going back. You can come if you want. And Brandon so graciously agreed that I could work from Indy for Tooth and Nail. So it was great for me because I could sleep until 11 and work because of the time change. But, I found a few bands like Cry of the Afflicted and Secret and Whisper and Search the City.
Good ones.
Those were really fun projects and people to work with. After a while, Brandon and I had a really good talk, and he was just like, Chad's moving to Nashville, Tennessee. I want you to continue to work for Tooth and Nail, but you're either going to have to move back to Seattle or move to Nashville with Chad. At that time, it was, I'm moving to Nashville with Chad. Chad's my boy. So we kind of worked out of the EMI office down there, and I kind of started that whole branch down there. It was awesome.
Wow. Let's take this opportunity then from this perspective of someone who was not a Tooth and Nail kid. And I'm curious, what are your favorite songs in the catalog? That could be interesting. I don't know where they might come from.
Can I give you an artist rather than songs?
If songs, you can give me a story or an experience to go with it.
Yeah, Starflyer 59. Man, every record that Starflyer I love, because it was kind of like he did not give a crap what anybody else thought. He did his own thing that was totally different. You know,
very original.
Really love Starflyer. I really love Demon Hunter, and a lot of it is because Ryan Clark is such an important guy to me. Something building, raging inside. I love Further Scenes Forever, you know, all those old records. You know, just kind of the more obscure, weird bands, I guess, is what I would say. But yeah, Starflyer is number one for me for sure, as far as Tooth and Nail artist.
That's really cool. So you make this other move to Nashville now. I guess that was okay with your ex-wife?
I moved down there before her for kind of the same reasons. She's like, you should just go. And I wasn't sure what was going to happen with our marriage at that point. She ended up moving down a few months later, and I can't remember the exact timing of it, if Chad was going to leave or I was going to leave first, but it was right around the same time when Chad left Tooth and Nail that I left. And I left because I got an opportunity to, my faith started like really getting strong again when I moved to Nashville, and I started going to this church, and they offered me a full-time position as a youth pastor, and it just kind of resonated with me, and I decided to step out of the music business and haven't been back since. That was a really neat time working with the church down there. And after a little while of doing that, I started touring full-time with Jeremy Camp. Jeremy has been a friend of mine since I was 18, and I just came on board kind of as his assistant. And
hang on a second, you were friends with Jeremy Camp when you were 18? That throws my whole mental timeline off here.
Yeah, so I got saved when I was 18. I went to Bible college 3 weeks after I got saved.
Uh-huh.
Jeremy's dad was one of the teachers at my Bible college. Jeremy was going to, I was at the Midwest Extension campus of a Bible college in California. Jeremy was going to that Bible college in California. So we just became fast friends through all that.
Wow. And so you then go work for Jeremy Camp as an assistant, like traveling with and things?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was on staff for him. Like I toured with him. That it right there is a very, very, very special man. And I know that like people in hardcore bands or whatever may not think that that's very cool, but that dude is legit. He really
what is so special about him?
I'll tell you what's special about Jeremy is, you know, as well as I do, being around Christian musicians, that there's a lot of, like what you said earlier, one person on stage and then there are a different person off stage. It's almost frustrating how real Jeremy is, because everything that he says on stage is who he really is off the stage. He's just a man that loves Jesus and loves his family and wants to tell people about Jesus. And that time that I got to spend with him was so, so awesome. He's a really good man.
So authentic, I guess, maybe is the thing there. 100%. So people could look totally different lifestyles or musical styles and still be authentic. Well, how did that one come to an end?
I ended up going through a divorce. My ex-wife at the time was touring with Britney Spears and I was touring with Jeremy Camp.
And what was she doing? I think I did know about this.
She was Britney's hairstylist.
Yeah, hear about that.
She was touring with Britney. And, you know, from the time I quit Haste the Day up until I got divorced, and even more so after, I really struggled with alcohol. It had become a big thing. And our marriage wasn't working out for various reasons. And we ended up getting divorced. I left tour with Jeremy because I felt like I needed to try everything I could to say that I fought for my marriage. So she moved back to Indiana. So I felt like it was the right thing for me to move back to Indiana. And I moved in with this guy named Mark LaFay. he kind of took me in, and, you know, without Mark, I would have been homeless. It's a really weird story. We ended up getting divorced. I had no job. I was living on my friend's couch. I gained 60 pounds that year. I was literally drunk, like nonstop. I was smoking 2 packs a day. Jesus was always in the back of my mind, but I really wasn't listening very clearly to him. I fell into this super dark depression. I started selling Boost Mobile phones, literally in the hood, because it's the only job that like I could find, because I was always drunk. I was a really big mess. That was probably the darkest time of my whole life. So fast forward, a friend of mine that I was actually, I've known since he was 16, runs a company here in Indianapolis, and he could see how dark things had gotten for me. And he offered me a job. And I took it, and I've been there 10 years. I still work for this man. And you know, I've lived 12 different lives, Matt.
Sounds like it.
Literally. And I mean, everything I'm saying right now, there's such a long story to all of it. Like I could go, there's an hour conversation to each one of these subjects we could have. But, you know, I'm really thankful for all those lives because I'm able to relate with a lot of different types of people.
What is this 10-year job that you've been in? That's the longest you've ever been in anything, huh?
It is. It is. And it's interesting you say that because I have some real godly men in my life that have said the same thing, that this has been like one of the best things for me because it's taught me consistency. It's taught me responsibility. It's taught me a lot of things. But I work for this company called Easy Water, and I help run the warehouse. We build water softeners and water treatment products. And I love it, man. I really do. My son, by the way, I am remarried and completely madly in love with my wife. And I have a 6-year-old boy named Ari. But my son, the other night I was laying in bed with him, and he says these things that are just bizarre, but he's like, "So tell me about your day, Dad." Like he said that to me. And I'm like, "Okay, well, I went to work and I came home and we wrestled." And he goes, no, but what was work like? And being able to look at my son in the eyes and say, well, Ari, I love going to work and I love the people that I work with. Like, I look forward to going to work every day, Matt. And it is so not glamorous. And it's not something that somebody who was a Haste of Day fan would want to hear. But the truth is, like, I'm just a dad that has a mustache and I work in a warehouse and I love truck drivers and I get to tell them about Jesus every day. It's freaking awesome.
That's really, really cool to hear. And it's not, I think I've heard similar things or things that rhyme with this before with people who have been in similar positions when they find a culture that they fit in and it's not about the things that they, you know, the money or the status or the success, but it's about the culture that they then fit into and just let that be. And it's like a form of practice, yeah. You know, where you really, whatever that is, it definitely resonates. I think a lot of people do understand that, you know, yeah. that to really to and be able to do it for that long and then still have a quiet spirit that's not restless about it. It means something. And I'm not saying there's a spiritual part to it. There's the overt spiritual part where you get to tell people about Jesus, but the like that spirituality, it seems like you do. To me, it's like all the things that you've been into, you go so deeply into them that it's I don't know what I'm saying here other than like if I have seen your Instagram over the last time or you know I've seen you online and stuff like that, you get into you do photography, biking is a phase, weightlifting, you know, your job, they all sound like they're on that list of things that you do that can be part of your life that you can go so deeply into and get meaning out of, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And the, you know, the lifting weights and the cycling and like, I am on a race team here in Indianapolis and, you know, those are ways that, you know, I've referenced this a few times, but I've been sober for 6 years and, the weightlifting and the cycling and things like that are ways that like, I kind of combat that in my mind. There's obviously a spiritual side to all of it, but like, I have found that like any type of active lifestyle is just very, very important for me. If that makes sense.
Active. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I got some of this material and questions from the fans in the Facebook group, but let's see if there's a couple other things that they had. I think I covered a good amount of them, but, somebody asked, I thought an interesting question. So there's an alternate version of the Everything Falls video. You know what I'm talking about? There was like a more commercial version that didn't have screaming on, or less.
So the When Everything Falls video, they wanted. When I say they, it was the label wanted the screaming taken out of the song so it would be more commercial. Which I don't know how Haste Today could be like more commercial, but yeah, like they just. They had me go back up to Vancouver and re-record like parts without screaming in it. That's why we did that. It was just kind of like, and to be honest with you, like when you're in a band and the label asks you to do something, it's almost like they're the one fronting the money for all of it. And you want to keep them happy. So it's like, yeah, of course I'll go back up there and do this. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like that's selling out. I think it's like trying to appease the people that are helping things move forward.
And did you like the way it turned out though, or did?
I did. Yeah.
But it's not on Spotify, so maybe it's out there and YouTube people can post it and stuff like that. I thought that was a fascinating little piece of trivia, at least from it. And then there's a lot of people that are asking about the future of Haste Today or the current of Haste Today. What is the status right now with you and the band?
Yeah. So, you know, like I said before, Steven and Mike are the two guys that quote unquote own the Haste Today brand. And Steven is doing a lot of musical stuff in Nashville. Like I said before, he's insanely talented. And I think he's like writing scores for movies and commercials and stuff. Like he's just so brilliant. Everybody in the band, except for one of us, I think has kids. And I mean, like Brennan is the head worship pastor of the largest church in Indiana. Like everybody's, Devin's a realtor. Like Mike is working at a big logistics company. Like everybody has these crazy responsibilities and things and kids and homes. And I think that as far as the future of Haste Today, as far as like every time I get asked a lot from bands or promoters or whatever, like, would you do this show for X amount of money? Or could we fly you here to do this? Every time I present that to Mike, it's been a no. So it's out of my hands. That's just the truth. And I, you know, like I totally get it. Like, I think it'd be fun. I think it'd be a blast to like play some shows, but that's all up to Mike and Steven.
It's possible in theory though. I mean, it's not just a no, it's just that they have something in mind that would be appropriate. And
it would be very, very surprising to me if something happened again. It really would be. I am in another band called Trenches.
I wanted to ask about Trenches. So tell me what, I mean, I remember when Trenches first, I don't even remember when it first came out, but I do remember the origin of that. But I'm curious what you would have to say about that across this time too.
Yeah. So we just had a record come out that we put out ourselves. It had been like 8 years or more that we were trying to do it, but like people lived in different states and everybody had different things in life come up, like babies or whatever. And we finally finished it this year. And I love it. It's one of my favorite things I've ever done musically. Because we took forever to do it, I had a lot of time to write, and it's just so different than anything I've done before. And anyway, we all live in Indy now, and we are playing, we're playing shows, but it's like few and far between, and it has to make a lot of sense for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things. And I'm sure you can understand, like everybody has jobs and responsibilities, and it just has to make a lot of sense and work out on everybody's calendar. But yeah,
I'm curious to check out the Trenches. I guess my area of curiosity would be the lyrics of the amount that you've been living and had time to work on them, and what all that comes from. I'm curious what those themes will be. They seem like that'd be something fascinating given your perspective and experience.
Yeah, it was really fun. We the last two records, we haven't posted any of the lyrics, and people have gotten really upset about that, and I don't care.
And this one saying that, so this one you're not going to post the lyrics or share them?
No.
I just have to really work hard to figure it out then. Okay.
Yeah. You need a translator.
Yeah. It's hard. That's hard in that style of music, especially. Mm-hmm. That is basically what I've got, Jimmy. I really appreciate you walking me through so much of your personal history that I, you know, haven't been present for, you know. I didn't even have your cell number. I just got it, but I should have had it, and I should have been, you know, been more in touch across that time span. So I'm appreciate getting to learn, you know, about your journey in this format.
Yeah. I like I said at the outset of this, I'm not just saying this. I really mean it. I'd do anything for you or any of the guys.
I believe you.
I mean, like, as gung-ho as I am with things, like I love my friends. And I mean, if Joe from Advent needed me tomorrow, I would drive to North Carolina. I would 100%. There's a lot of really great people that I really care about and have met through this journey. And I think so highly of you and all the guys in your band. It's just, like I said, it's just a special group of people that we had a really neat, neat experience together. So I love you, and I'm thankful that you let me do this. And I'm thankful for anybody that decided to listen to it.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking a lot of people are quite excited about it, and for good reason. And I'm going to talk to Keech next week.
Awesome. So, please, dude, if you can, tell him I was singing his praises, because I do love that man.
Yeah, I'm sure he knows, but that's in your character, and he'll probably listen to this one before I tape with him. So, but yeah, it seems like you guys have been able to obviously get along. I mean, I think that's a real special relationship with the band. You know, it just speaks to the solidness of the band, the group of people, knowing what it was, being able to change lead singers, have those lead singers interact, collaborate over time. There's more stories to tell about that. I know you guys have collaborated even in the past, done shows, all kind of stuff. But I've always been a big fan of Hey Sade and the energy they could bring. So thank you for being part of that creation that's going to continue to live on, you know, even if Mike and Steven won't let y'all play any shows.
Thanks, Matt. I'll talk to you soon, brother.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Labeled. My name is Sean Carpenter, and I am from Kannapolis, North Carolina, and I have been listening since 2018. A favorite song of mine is Cadence by Amber Lamb, because it reminds me of how I feel about my wife, and I even had a blasting at the reception of my wedding last year. Labeled is produced by Matt Carter and Knucklebreaker Productions and Compound 3 Recordings. Editing and sound design by Seth Thompson. Editorial oversight by Jim Worthen and Adam Scutula. Brand and design direction by Joel Buchelman. Our production manager is Katie Franson. Executive producers Brandon Ebel and Matt Carter. Additional support from Marshall Friedman, Tyson Paolesi, and Anna Merziglocki. See you next time.